Thank you very much.
Our senator, are you the only one that wishes to testify on this? Do we have a map sheet?
It's a hot topic, Mr. Chair.
You may make it easy for us. Let me ask you a question in advance. Do you mind being the carrier?
Not at all, sir.
Okay. I'm ready to hearing an open work session on SJM 5. And that.
Before I even introduce a bill, I just want to say that I'll vote for it as long as he doesn't make any smart remarks about me in his fourth. Is that okay? Mr. Chair, I move Senate Joint Memorial 5 to the House, the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Let's move it to the House.
We have to use the word adopt here.
Adopt. You phrase it.
I don't know that the chair can put words in his
mouth. He's putting words in my mouth all the time. So adopted.
Senator Shields moves to adopt SJM 5 and send it to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is that the words you wanted to hear?
Yes, that's what I wanted to hear.
Thank you. Further discussion?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
I would just like to quote what is in this article, and it says, it is a fundamental issue of fairness, and I think that just about says it all.
Mm-hmm. Hearing no more discussion and no objections, will the clerk call the roll? I might say before we take the vote that both Senator Carter, who is home ill, and Senator Meserle, who had to go back to the district early today for a meeting, are excused and would have liked to have been here and support these issues. Go ahead.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Carter?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye.
The motion carries, and Senator Corcoran will carry the bill. Public work session on SJM 5 and open a public hearing on SB 904. Introduce the bill.
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 904 creates the Brain Injury Trust Fund Board, requires the board to seek grants and contributions, directs the board to solicit review and application for grants for community-based services. It creates the Brain Trust Injury Fund, vests the board with authority to approve applications for grants and disperse monies from the trust fund for services, and appropriates monies to the board to carry out the functions. And some brief background, traumatic brain injury, or TBI, is usually caused by external force to the head, such as from a vehicle accident or fall, and that results in diminished or altered state of consciousness. TBI can result in also changes in the individual's behavior, emotional function, as well as other physical and cognitive impairments. The Brain Injury Association reports that 1.5 million Americans sustain TBI each year, and that 80,000 of these individuals experience a long-term disabling condition. In 1997 and 98, the Oregon Health Division identified 6,791 cases of individuals hospitalized in the state for TBI. On April 3, the governor signed an executive order creating the Task Force on Traumatic Brain Injury. The task force, amongst other things, is charged with analyzing and making recommendations regarding state agency response to people with TBI, exploring sources for funding, TBI trust fund, reviewing costs, and similar duties. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means and has attached a fiscal impact statement.
Okay. Ellie Jenny and Bill Olson. A little crowded yesterday.
Yes. See if I can do this so I can get this to heard by everyone and on the record. Chair Fisher and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ellie Jenny, and I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 904. This proposal, I think... would really do some good to a population that's yet to be served. I mean, I know you have a lot of populations with a lot of issues, we're not asking for a lot of money. I think that what the head injured folks need most is recognition and access to services as a part of the service framework. I think right now they fall through the cracks because they don't necessarily fit the definitions of Social Security disability and the different state definitions of disability. You could say fortunately at the time of my head injury 35 years ago, also had a spinal cord injury, and so therefore a lot of my physical needs were met. I had to retrain myself. It took about 15 years to put my life back together after I was in a coma for about a month from a significant head injury in 1966. And I know that a lot of folks who recover or receive and live through, survive a head injury, will need some kind of social structure the rest of their life. And I think right now that those needs aren't being met, that families are being burdened. I don't like that word, but that's kind of what I feel like it would be, meeting needs that the state or insurance companies just haven't seen as valid up until now. And I thank you for the opportunity to share, and we'd be open, you know, for questions.
Thank you very much, Ellie. Appreciate your concerted effort here at the Capitol. You're a very faithful person to be here, and you've sat through an awful lot of hearings. Go ahead, Mr. Olson.
Chair Fisher, member of the committee, my name is Bill Olson. I'm volunteer president of the Brain Injury Association of Oregon. For the record, my address is 2797 Breckenridge Loop, Northwest, Salem, 97304. The association's mission is to improve the quality of life for persons with brain injury and their families, and to prevent brain injury, a very important mission that we feel strongly about, having in many cases experienced the consequences of brain injury ourselves. As a personal note, my son Michael received a brainstem contusion from an accident while he was skiing in 1983. Michael has no observable physical disability, but he has a severe cognitive deficit from his injury, including short-term memory loss and periodic seizures that have never been fully controlled by medication, which make it really impossible for him to live fully independently. I'm here today, of course, to speak in support of Senate Bill 904, which Rick has described and summarized, so I won't talk about that, what it does, but I want to give you ultimately our reasons for the support of the bill. I also want to share with you some of the magnitude of the issue of brain injury, both nationally and in Oregon. In the packet that I've submitted, I won't, as I say, go through it in detail, but you have some data sheets there. Most of the data that we're presenting are from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and are based upon some traumatic brain injury registries and surveillance programs in, I think, about 15 states around the country. Oregon is not one of those states. Just a word on definitions. The term traumatic brain injury is utilized, and you'll see it frequently, because that's where we get our data on brain injury. However, for the Senate Bill 904 incorporates a definition which is commonly referred to as acquired brain injury. It's a broader term than traumatic brain injury and includes injuries that might occur from causes such as anoxia, aneurysm, infection, and stroke. And in fact, in the testimony that you have from one of our members in Lincoln City, that was the cause of the brain injury in that case. Just to highlight a few points, Rick mentioned that I think that 80,000 people in the United States experience the onset of a long-term disability following brain injury. Yeah, for Oregon, the estimate that we have for the year 2000 is 1,202, or 35% of the over 3,300 people that are hospitalized for TBI. Forgive my mouth being a little dry, which I think will help shorten my presentation. We don't have an estimate for the total number of Oregonians who are living with TBI disability. However, if we take the if our share of the 5.3 million national figure that CDC provides us, and we take Oregon's proportion of the population, we would have slightly over 41,000 people living with TBI. So that's the best I can do, because we don't have those data for the state of Oregon. In terms of comparative annual incidence and long-term disability from various injuries and illnesses, I've included some data sheets in the packets that you have that compare traumatic brain injury with other, as I say, other illnesses, such as multiple sclerosis, spinal cord injury, and HIV/AIDS. I want to make the point here that in presenting those data, we are not trying to diminish or say that these other illnesses and injuries are not important. We're simply trying to put brain injury in context and break the silence about brain injury and say this also is significant, this also deserves some national and state attention. In terms of deaths from TBI, 884 Oregonians died, or estimated to have died, as a result of TBI in the year 2000. I should add that over the last 30 years, the rate of death from TBI has been decreasing, and Oregon has done some good things in that regard. Seatbelt laws, helmet laws, DUI, alcohol blood levels being reduced, all of those things are statistically demonstrably reducing death from brain injury. Among the causes of brain injury, accidents and falls are by far the most significant causes, and the risk of TBI is highest among adolescents, young adults, and those older than 75, mostly from falls. Rick has mentioned some of the cognitive the consequences of brain injury. Just to mention a couple, memory loss, which my son has experienced, makes it extremely difficult to learn new information. So learning, getting a job, and adjusting to changes on the job, all of those things are enormously difficult if your short-term memory is basically shot. It takes longer, greater repetition, and it's a frequent, though not universal, consequence of brain injury. Emotional and behavioral changes are also an important and very stressful consequence of brain injury, not only for the individual but for the family. You have in your packet a letter, written testimonial from Lori Burke of Lincoln City. She movingly, I think, describes her family's situation as a result of an injury that her husband suffered 3 years ago. And I can't say it any better or as well as she did, but that's an enormous issue for people, and there's not enough help out there for them.
Bill, I have some questions. We did something similar to this for the spinal cord folks a couple years ago, and they're back now with a pretty husky request for funds, and apparently have done practically nothing in the way of soliciting or getting funds from donated sources, and I just thought that we ought to discuss a little bit about how you hope to maybe do a little better than that, or and I know that, and I'm not telling you that in the future that you could never come before the state people for additional funding, but we definitely are trying to do this with the idea of capturing and using additional funds that we would not have be able to tap otherwise. And so I really want to, I guess, impress you as much as possible the probably the amount of weight that that activity will bear in being able to continue the program through the future, or be able to get state funds, especially in a if we're unfortunate to continue a declining economy. So maybe you could just outline for the record what your goals are and what you folks are planning to do in that process.
Certainly. In our, well, first of all, let me speak to the relationship between this fund and the Spinal Cord Research Fund, because we definitely looked at that as a model for our legislative request. The Spinal Cord Research Fund was talking about doing basic research to overcome spinal cord injury, a cure for spinal cord injury. Such research is enormously expensive, my understanding, at least. For example, in pushing for appropriations, which we did in Washington, to increase NIH appropriations for the study of cognitive and neurobehavioral impairment, we were thinking of, we, the National Brain Injury Association, I'm speaking for now, we're thinking of two studies, each of which would cost $2.5 million. So when you're playing in those terms, in those areas, you're talking pretty significant money, even if you're just talking a match or a complement to some outside source. And in terms of the services that we're looking at, the grants could be much smaller and still provide some direct service. So I think I can't guarantee you that we will be successful in getting money into the trust fund, but I think we have a much better opportunity because our service can be targeted, and for example, a demonstration project in which the state is involved but perhaps doesn't put up a lot of money, but they have some staff involvement, would be an example, and I think we have a better chance to do that than basic research of the type that the Spinal Cord Injury Research Fund is proposing.
Well, I just felt that I needed to get this on record and to maybe lend some impetus to you and lend some importance to your search for those funds and soliciting for those funds. And I definitely, as a chair of the committee, want to be as helpful as I can in the process and to give you the benefit of anything that I can. And I hadn't had a chance to talk with you. I just found this out yesterday, and so I hadn't had a chance to brief you on it. Otherwise, I would have, but I thought that at least we could discuss it here and put it on the record, and then it would be something that you would be well aware of, because it was brought to me a bit in a manner like, you know, well, we did this and gave them an opportunity, and now basically they haven't done anything, but they're back here asking for money. Well, I understand how hard it is to do things. You don't always just take off on fire from the starting gun either, you know, and so I believe that we can give you a boost on the way, and like I said, I certainly am not telling you not to come back, you know, and with reasonable requests and that kind of thing in the future and what your board deems is necessary or whatever, but just letting you know that it certainly would be, I'm sure, add to your credit and credibility to be able to show at least some measurable efforts on those projects. Further questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. I'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 904. Mr. Chair?
Thank you. I move Senate Bill 904 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
I think it has to be, it has subsequent referral ways.
Oh, okay. To Ways and Means.
Senator Shields moves that we, let's see, we pass this one to Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation by prior reference to the Ways and Means Committee. Further discussion?
I'm just wondering, why does it have to go to Ways and Means if it's money that they're raising themselves? I don't understand that.
Yes, I'll have staff address that because I don't want to show my ignorance.
As Senator Shields has explained to me, because it's developing a new program, even though it's a dollar, anytime a new program is developed, it may have any kind of appropriations now or input from LFO in the future. They request to come before Ways and Means to kind of get it into the system.
Okay.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Rick. Any further discussion? Objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Steele?
Aye.
Senator Bird?
Aye.
Senator Fisher?
Aye. The motion carries, and
yes,
then do we have to excuse them each on each vote, or just excuse them for the entire? Both Senator Carter and Senator Mazzarelli are excused. The motion carries, and
doesn't
we will wish you folks every success in the coming work that you're now getting an opportunity probably to carry out. Close the work session on Senate Bill 904 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 575.
Peter, Senator.
Yes, staff, I can introduce it.
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 575 requires the Health Division to develop a monitoring system for babies who do not receive newborn hearing screening tests, appropriates money to the Health Division to implement newborn screening tests at hospitals, Oregon hospitals, and birthing centers that do not currently provide such tests. As some background, research studies have demonstrated that diagnosis of hearing impairments at an early age and interventions by age 6 months can result in significantly better success for young children as they grow. Currently, many children do not have hearing impairment identification until 2 to 2.5 years old. The division reports that children who are diagnosed with hearing loss receive early intervention services before 6 months of age, develop better communication, language skills, and similar skills. The division reports that up to 300 Oregon babies are born deaf or hard of hearing each year. In 1999, House Bill 3246 required that all hospitals with more than 200 births per year need to screen all their babies for hearing loss. Infants receive a hearing test by 1 month, usually before leaving the hospital. Those who do not pass the screening test receive a complete diagnosis or diagnostic testing by an audiologist or neurologist. After undergoing testing, babies that are found to be deaf or hard of hearing are referred to early intervention services that may include hearing aids, discussion of surgery, training for the families and the babies. This also has subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, before we start testimony on this, I forgot to read into the last work session a letter, so I'm going to briefly or recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 575 and reopen the work session on Senate Bill 904. This is a letter that I am going to read into the record. Is from Senator Kate Brown, and it is in support of SB 904, and with that I will close the work session on Senate Bill 904 and reopen the work session on Senate Bill 575. I'm sorry, I'll reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 575. Tom Bessonette and Judy Brown and Valerie Schuyler. Hope I got those all right.
Chairman Fisher, I'm Tom Bessonette with the Oregon Lions clubs of the state of Oregon, and with me is Judy Brown. Judy Brown has is a grandmother of a deaf child, and she started this whole process 4 years ago. In last session, as we know, we did get unanimous, well, all but one vote in the body going through for a half a loaf of as far as testing newborn babies at the hearing in the hospital. First off, it was amazing to me that we could even test these babies. I'm old-fashioned, and the fact is I even thought I heard in the reading of the definition, the organization of the bill, that we were going to be checking just babies that had failed the test in the hospital or something of that nature. Actually, we want to keep track of all the babies, those that have passed as well as those who have failed. But we'll go into more detail on that. First, I'd like to let Judy Brown tell her story, and then I'll come back and talk about the bill itself.
Thank you. Chair Fisher and committee members, I'm Judy Brown of Carlton, president of the Oregon chapter of the Alexander Graham Bell Association for the Deaf, and member of Oregon's Universal Newborn Hearing Screening Advisory Committee. I'm the grandmother of a profoundly deaf, late-diagnosed 12-year-old child. My testimony is in favor of Senate Bill 575 and amendments which will be proposed to bring the bill more in line with the UNHS Advisory Committee's 2001 report. The Oregon legislature last session initiated the creation of a newborn hearing screening program for our state and established an advisory committee to provide assistance to the health division as the program was implemented. I have attached portions of pages 7 and 8 of the committee's January 2001 report to my testimony because they speak to the broad-based representation of the committee and to the results of our involvement. This has truly been a well-represented committee. The advisory committee believes a solid foundation has been laid for the development of a strong and effective early hearing loss detection and intervention program for our state. On behalf of Oregon AG Bell, I express sincere appreciation to the legislature for establishing the hearing screening program in Oregon. Prior to July 1, 2000, when the program was implemented in Oregon, fewer than 25% of the babies in the state were offered hearing screening. Now, 43 hospitals and 26 counties across the state have operational programs, and approximately 94% of our 46,000 babies are being screened. This represents an incredible accomplishment. Individual hospitals have put forth considerable effort to establish and maintain their screening programs. They've had to absorb costs of equipment, training, and screening personnel, and the screening itself, for which there is limited reimbursement. They were willing to do this because they knew how desperately this was needed. At this time, 12 hospitals are not mandated to perform screening under the current bill, although 4 of the 43 screening hospitals are small hospitals voluntarily complying with the law. You need to understand that screening tests are just that. If the screen results in questions about an infant's hearing status, further diagnostic testing is necessary. 12 facilities serving Oregonians are capable of performing diagnostic tests using guidelines established by our advisory committee. If a hearing loss is confirmed through diagnostic testing, the infant should be immediately enrolled in early intervention. There are 8 public regional programs across our state offering services to these children and 3 private programs, 1 in Eugene and 2 in Portland. The current legislation requires hospitals to report annually the number of newborns screened and the number who do not pass the screening. Early intervention facilities are required to report how many deaf or hard of hearing children they are serving. The law does not provide for reporting from diagnostic facilities, nor for the reporting of the results of screening, diagnostic testing, and EI enrollment on an individual basis, which the advisory committee believes early intervention, okay. I'm sorry, which the advisory committee believes is the only way to match up the information from the 3 sources. It is anticipated that more than 100 severely affected children are born in Oregon each year, yet in 1999, our early intervention facilities enrolled only 12 children less than 6 months old. For this program to be successful, parents must navigate 3 stages: screening, diagnostic testing, and early intervention enrollment. The experience of other states shows that in the absence of a follow-up data system, half of all the children who are referred for diagnostic testing will fail to receive this testing. Some families with infants diagnosed with hearing loss fail to apply for early intervention services. Without the legislative authority to establish a data tracking system, I believe there is no way to effectively monitor the performance of the entire program to establish geographic, economic competency, and other barriers. For these reasons, I urge passage of Senate Bill 575 and amendment. Thank you for considering my testimony. I'll answer questions if you have any.
Mr. Chair, do you have any amendments? I don't know.
No.
Okay.
Thank you, Tom. Questions?
Don't believe we have any. Okay. At least not at this point in time, Valerie.
Did you want to finish?
May I finish?
Oh,
I'll go through some of the bill itself. You have before you a copy of this and I'd like to refer to that in a moment or two, but first off, I'd like to thank each one of you senators for voting for the bill last session. I would also like to make a note that in a moment of weakness, I requested this bill on behalf of Tom Bessonnet. Actually, that it's much broader than that. It's requested at the Advisory Council Committee for the newborn screening. But that I just want to disavow ownership of this idea is what I'm trying to do there. We could pack this room with members of the Advisory Committee because originally the bill last session asked for 11 members to be on the Advisory Committee. We blacked out and just said an advisory committee would be appointed by the health division. They appointed 46 people to this advisory committee of all different walks of life. So doctors, the hospital, audiologists, the Lions Club, and people who were deaf and had received or parents of deaf children. And as a result of that, we had a broad understanding of the problems of the deaf and the hard of hearing. I also want to thank the hospitals for their involvement in this. Even though it's statutorily, it still costs them a substantial amount of money for the equipment and the training. And that's one of the reasons why we have in the bill a ways and means request for $200,000 to help the small hospitals that now do not have to comply with the testing but would like to have their children tested but can't afford it because they have too few of births. What it amounts to here is we look at the bottom of the box. I'll just try and walk you through what happens to a baby. The baby is tested in the hospital as soon as possible. That test can be done within 2 hours of birth. That just continually blows my mind, but it can be done. It's not normally done that soon, but it is done once or twice before the child is discharged from the hospital. If they test them and they find that there is a potential hearing problem, they like to retest them to determine whether or not there is, in fact, a hearing problem or whether it was just an abnormality in the test itself. But if they have a hearing problem that is diagnosed, then the parents are asked to go, under the current law, asked to go to the diagnostic testing center near them to have further and in-depth testing that you'll hear more about in a little bit here. And then if they have a problem, they can go immediately to the early intervention, which is education for the parents as well as the child, even at the age of 6 months. You have another handout about a baby that was born prior to the testing, but the parents followed through on what was going on, had a cochlear implant, as well as teaching the child to sign language at the age of 18 months. As 97 words that they can sign. I mean, it's fantastic what's going on today in the area of the hard of hearing. So we come before you to ask that the half a loaf we got last time is the testing at the hospitals. Now we have to have the tracking system that checks the babies that are in the hearing screening at the hospital and those that need to go to the diagnostic center. We need to know their names, so that the health department can send the local health division out to check with the parents to make certain that they go through the process and then into the early intervention if it's necessary. So we need the reports from the hospitals, we need the reports from the diagnostic testing center, and we need the reports from the early intervention, or as Mrs. Brown said, 50% of the children in other states fall through the cracks and do not receive the improved outcome that comes from all of these programs. Now, some of the financing of that, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention has funded the positions for this follow-up people. It's on an annual grant, renewable for 5 years. But our request for the $200,000 is to try and fund some of the hospitals that do not now test because they're so small. The amendments that we referred to earlier, we got a little bit fouled up on getting them printed for you, but they basically allows the, they changed the bill so that there will, the data will be forwarded from the hospital to the Oregon Health Division, the diagnostic lab, to the Oregon Hospital Division, or the Oregon Health Division, early intervention to the Health Division also. And we do that, the timeline as to when these reports are necessary to go to the Oregon Health Division by rule. Because the legislative, if we put it into the law, it's inflexible. And sometimes some hospitals need a little bit more time than other hospitals. And the timeline between when the hospital is, the information from the hospital is needed is different than when it's needed from the diagnostic lab or from early intervention. So we ask in the amendments that this all be done through the process of the rules hearing because they're more flexible. We can get up close and personal and talk to the people that are actually involved in the testing and so on and make it more, friendly user. User-friendly, I guess I should say. So we do recommend this bill be passed, but we will be back with our amendments very soon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Valerie Schuyler. I'm Director of Infant Hearing Resource at the Hearing and Speech Institute, and I'm also a member of the Advisory Committee on Newborn Hearing Screening to the Oregon Health Division. I want to tell you, I am operating in the intervention end of this process, so I'm not in the hospitals or the diagnostic center, although we have a diagnostic center at the Institute, but I work with the families of infants who have been diagnosed with hearing loss. I want to tell you what is happening in terms of this process for infants since July. Nationally, 3 in 1,000 babies are born with hearing loss. So with 48,000 births per year in Oregon, we would expect that there are about 144 children who are deaf and hard of hearing born in Oregon every year. Right now, 95% of those babies, or 137 of them with hearing loss, are being born in hospitals that are required to screen. And approximately half of these 137 newborns who we are anticipating be born with hearing loss in Oregon are born in the Portland metropolitan area. So I thought it would be helpful if I did a little survey of the early intervention sites to see at this point in the year, we've had, at the end of January, we've had 7 months passed with screening. How many babies would we have expected to find and how many are we now seeing in intervention? If all the babies who by 7/12 of the year, 7/12 of the half of 137, which is 68 babies, getting a lot of numbers here, we would have expected to find 40 babies by the end of January, who by now, as of April, would have been enrolled in intervention. We figure it gives them a couple of months to get from the hospital to here. We would have expected to have 40 deaf or hard of hearing babies enrolled in early intervention. We are working right now in the three programs in the Portland area with 16 babies. That's 16 more than we would have been working with at this time last year. But there are 24 babies out there who are deaf or hard of hearing who have not yet been identified. Where are these babies?
That's statistically or actual count.
The 16 is actual, the 24 is statistical. So there's 24 babies by, in terms of what we anticipate being born, who have not shown up in early intervention to this point in the year.
I would hope your anticipation is wrong.
It's a lot of babies. Yes, it's a lot of babies. As Judy reported in other states, 50% of the babies when there's no tracking system are lost in the process. Right now, 60% appear to be lost in the process in Oregon to date.
So you're telling us basically now that you don't have any correlation between what comes out of the hospital and what comes...
That's correct. We do not know the names of these babies. We don't know who their parents are. They are out there, and we have no way of knowing.
We don't have a number either.
Right. So, universal newborn hearing screening is both Tom and Judy have said is the first step in a three-step process. It's not an end in itself. If the babies don't get into intervention, really, newborn hearing screening has no point. What we're seeing now is with no way to track these babies, with no way to follow them, with no way to talk to parents who have not brought their babies who failed hearing screening in the hospital in for diagnosis, no way to call them up and say it's important to determine why your baby failed screening in the hospital. Those babies are not getting the help that they need. So we urge you to pass Senate Bill 575, which allows and requires hospitals, diagnostic centers, and early intervention sites to report the names of the children that we see so that we can track and make sure that these babies are identified. Thank you.
Senator Shields.
I'm just having a hard time because I can't imagine a parent not responding to the fact that their child failed a test at the hospital level and that we've got to chase them down. You'd think that they would be beating a path to the diagnostic center on their own initiative.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't understand that.
Yeah, I think I could speak to that. When you have a little baby, my daughter went through this, she looks perfect. She's full term, she's healthy, plump, beautiful, she looks perfect. If someone had told my daughter at that point that the baby was hearing impaired or there might be a hearing impairment, indeed she would have taken her in. But there are many parents today who, because the disability is invisible, number one, because their lives are perhaps more stressful than my daughter's was, number two, they have a lot of things going on and they just don't find the time to do that. For whatever reason, they put it off. Now, they may put it off for 6 months when the child doesn't begin to babble like she should. But what we're trying to do is get this down to those first few critical months. We've got a window here of maybe 3 years, and we want to take total advantage of these early months. So I definitely hear what you're saying. There's a lot of denial. That can't be. That can't be. Not with this beautiful, perfect baby. I think that's part of it.
And I think the other part that many of us don't know is that 90% of babies with hearing loss of any degree are born to parents who have perfectly normal hearing and there's no hearing loss in their family. So it's a recessive genetic trait, or there may have been a mother contracted a virus during pregnancy which created a hearing loss. They have no reason to expect the baby's hearing impaired. Some of these babies have, let's say, a moderate hearing loss. The parent comes up behind them, makes a loud sound, the baby responds because they have some hearing. It's not an all-or-nothing thing. And so right there, the parents say, oh, I don't need to worry about this. Baby responds to sound. What they don't understand is that even a mild, moderate hearing loss can cause very educationally significant delays in language acquisition and future educational achievement.
Mm-hmm. In response also, Senator Shields, the original bill drafted to last session did require the tracking system, but for the reason you identified, the fact that it's incomprehensible, Representative Lewis wanted that language dropped out, and we did. Now we're coming back for the second half of that loaf because we followed her dictates. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Loris, is it Orphanakis? I'm trying to get close to it here, but I... John McCulley and Claire Nelson.
With my apologies to the butchering of somebody's name.
We'll blame my husband for that Greek class.
Okay. Yeah, I don't have anything. I took Greek.
Oh, okay. My name is Dolores Orfanakis. I'm a pediatrician at Emanuel Children's Hospital, and I represent the Oregon Pediatric Society in behalf of the Senate bill. Now, as pediatricians in the community, we fully support this bill, recognizing that hearing loss is more common than all of the other disorders we screen for in the state of Oregon combined.
Hmm.
Maybe the rest of you are aware of our very elegant and comprehensive screening system that is affectionately called the PKU and does thyroid and hemoglobin. And it has with it all of the components that are asked to be added to the current bill. But I think it's really impressive to remember that we screen for this myriad of other diseases, and even if we combine all of them, they're less frequent combined than hearing, significant hearing loss. Something that the previous individuals talked about, I think, but needs to be emphasized is that there's a critical window, and that if you get to these children before 6 months of age and look at their functioning at 3 years of age, they'll be in the normal range. If they're not fitted with aids and intervened before 6 months of age, a very significant percentage of these children do not function in the normal range. And this has incredible personal, mental health, and economic impact in the very short term and in the very long term. The hospitals, which I'm involved with, have all stepped forward to do this screening, and there's essentially no reimbursement for it. It's important to remember that as we do these babies in the hospital, we will send out, even under the best systems, about 3 to 4 babies per 100 who need follow-up. Remember, the incidence of the disorder is only 3 to 4 per 1,000. So it's simply screening in the hospital, and we even try and avoid using the word screening. I mean, testing. We like to use just the word screening. The real diagnosis comes after. It's universal hearing screening occurs in a large number of states, and their experience is very similar, the 50% number again. A quarter of our families are in poverty. They don't have the developmental skills to recognize a hearing loss. And even as a pediatrician, I've seen a number of these kids who I know have profound hearing losses, and I can't tell it under 3 months of age. So it's not even a criticism of the parents, but the Oregon Pediatric Society and the hospitals that I represent are in full support of these additive measures to make this a program rather than simply hearing screening in the hospital. Thank you.
Chair Fisher and members of the committee, my name is Claire Nelson. I'm a parent, an advocate, and a member of the Self-Help for the Hard of Hearing, and I'm from Salem. And thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm an advocate, and I work with families with children with hearing loss. And I'm also the parent of a 14-year-old middle school daughter here in Salem who has a hearing loss. And I'm becoming increasingly more aware of the compelling reasons of the necessity to detect the hearing loss very early in our children. From personal experience, I can share with you, our daughter was not diagnosed until 4. We watched her. She looked normal to us. You heard Judy testify prior to us. They looked normal. They looked healthy. It was not until 4 when we took her in for what we thought was a vision and hearing screening, thinking she would come back with possibly a vision loss, which is very characteristic in our family, that we found her hearing loss. It came as a shock. The signs were not there for her dad or for I. We looked at her every day. She made babbling sounds, but we just didn't know that she had that loss. In retrospect, when we look through our family history, we do carry a genetic predisposition to a hearing loss, but it wasn't until approximately 2 years ago we found that genetic predisposition. My daughter is an advanced placement student at this point. She goes to school at Crossler. She's totally mainstreamed. She does wear digital hearing aids, and she is totally oral. If we had been given the opportunity to screen her at the age of at birth, we probably would have done that, but 10 years ago that was not necessarily there. We probably would have done a lot of things differently. Her language was delayed. We did a lot of early intervention at 4 when she was finally diagnosed. We had a specialist come into our home and work with language with her and with my husband and I, and we did not find that was a personal choice for us. And we're seeing more and more studies that show that if we work with our children before the age of 6 months, that language acquisition is increased and auditory skills are increased. And I really urge you to support not only this bill, but the monetary appropriations that go along with newborn hearing screening and the tracking that is necessary. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John McCulley representing the Oregon Speech Language Hearing Association. I'm not going to be able to add a lot to all of the excellent testimony you've heard today other than to put on the record our organization's support for Senate Bill 575. I represent the professionals, the audiologists and speech-language pathologists who are part of this continuum of care that's going to be involved in the early intervention and treatment of the disorders. and we fully support the idea that behind Senate Bill 575 and the information that you've heard about the impact, the very positive impact that early intervention can have on children and help them lead successful lives both in school and in the community. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Now that concludes our testimony today, so we'll wait for the amendments, and as soon as we can get those, we'll bring this back for more work. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 575 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 734. Staff will introduce the bill.
Thank you, Senator. Senate Bill 734 makes discretionary the provision of family planning and birth control services available within limits of funding by the Department of Human Services and county health departments. It eliminates requirements that local public health authority or health district provide parent and child health services, including family planning clinics. As some brief background, county health departments address community-level health issues while offering selected health care services to those who do not have access to private providers. In the calendar year 2000, local county health departments provided more than 58,000 clients with birth control and family planning. Many of these were teenagers and minorities. The Health Division reports this bill may reduce federal funding if certain mandated services are no longer available. And if counties opt out of local delivery, the Health Division may have to step in. On the other hand, if counties do not provide services and Health Division does not pick up, it could very well save money to counties.
Okay. Robert Ekstrom.
Good afternoon. We're thankful to have the opportunity to be here with you today. There were some other people who wanted to come and make public testimony on the bill, but the schedule for this hearing changed rather suddenly, and some of the county commissioners and other expert testimony that you have lined up I'm not able to make it here personally, but I think that you have some email comments that I hope will be read into the record.
I have some to read into them.
Okay, very good. My name is Robert Ekstrom. I live in Scappoose, Oregon. My husband, a father, small businessman, a concerned citizen. And recently, I was up in St. Helens, the county seat for Columbia County, and speaking with my county commissioner about a concern that I had regarding our county health district and a program that administered prescriptions for contraceptive drugs, Norplant, Depo-Provera, powerful drugs to 12 to 18-year-old girls, as well as referrals for abortions. And as I understood it, this all took place without the involvement of the parents. And in fact, that there were instances where parents didn't find out about these prescriptions or referrals for abortions until problems arose afterwards, emotional, physical problems. And so as I asked my county commissioner about it and questioned the wisdom of this kind of policy and program, he informed me that, well, Bob, it's required by Oregon law that we do this. In fact, I'd like to do something different. I don't agree with this program, but if we could have the law changed, I would prefer that. I spoke with another one of my county commissioners, same response, and since have spoken with county commissioners across the state of Oregon and have found that there are, in fact, counties that really would do something quite different if they were given the freedom and the jurisdiction. So this bill, Senate Bill 734, briefly says that the word shall in ORS 435-205 would be changed to may. It's the changing of just simply one word. And it takes it out of a coercive nature into a more voluntary nature of law. And I'd just like to touch on a couple of the things that I think this bill would do in the way of solving problems. A number one problem that the current law has is that it contradicts wise family policy. We depend upon parents to guide their children wisely and with love until the child reaches the age of legal maturity. Parents typically make sacrificial investments in their child, provide the basics of physical sustenance, the best education available, and a set of values that will point the child toward a successful life. I have written here in my testimony that there is considerable resentment on the part of parents when their county runs a program that prescribes powerful contraceptive drugs to their 12 to 18 year old daughter and makes a referral for abortion without their having any knowledge of it until some physical or emotional problem arises, at which point the parent is expected to again pick up the responsibility. This just doesn't sit well with many of our citizens in Oregon, and I think probably you gentlemen understand that. And I also know that none of you or nobody here in this current session of the legislature wrote and put into law what we hope to change. Current law contradicts the themes of American freedom. It's not disputable that in every document that we have, going all the way from the Mayflower Compact to the Declaration of Independence, our U.S. Constitution, our Oregon Constitution, the underlying principle is the consent of the governed. And that's where wisdom and proper implementation of public policy, I think, has to find its proper place, and always looking not for a force, but rather voluntary implementation where the citizens welcome the policy rather than are being told that this is what they shall do. In fact, we had not too long ago a situation where in the country of Germany, some German citizens were told by their government that they shall remain within the boundaries of a certain wall. And a day came when we all rejoiced with them when they were told that they may remain within the boundaries of that wall. And honesty requires us, uncomfortable as it might be sometimes, to take a look if perhaps we haven't got some hypocrisy in our law here in Oregon, where we are telling citizens that they shall do something rather than may. And if it's for their good, surely they should know that and be left to choose it rather than be forced to have a certain program put upon them. Current law contradicts the rule of local control. If we believe that citizens in their communities, through their locally elected representatives, should make the decisions that apply to them as much as possible, with the state and the federal government coming along with policies only as necessary, but that keeping things local is the best in terms of freedom and satisfaction, the pursuit of happiness, then this law should be changed for that reason. The current law also creates a real liability risk, I think, for the state and the counties. There are proven health risks and consequences regarding the use of contraceptives, and the same is true regarding abortion. It is not difficult to imagine a series of lawsuits both individual and class action that could result. The health of girls is negatively affected either in particular instances or in the eventual determination of group harm. This concern should not be ruled out. There will be those who oppose changing the word shall to may, as this law, as this bill hopes to do. And I'd like to say, from my understanding, that Senate Bill 734 does not touch the right that the U.S. Supreme Court has declared regarding a woman's right to abortion. It does not touch that. That remains in place, whether you like it or not. But Senate Bill 734 would certainly give people at the different counties here in Oregon the ability to address whether or not that's something that their tax dollars will pay for. I'd like to point out that we have rights that we all agree upon, and some of them are more explicitly written into our Constitution. Free speech, worship, right to keep and bear arms, property. The right to an abortion was a little harder to find. It took 184 years. But do we run programs to ensure that our citizens engage in free speech? Do we run programs to ensure that they worship freely? Do we run programs to ensure that they avail themselves of the right to keep and bear arms or have protection regarding their property? We don't. But we do have a program in this case that maybe in its optionality might be something that this or that county does want to run and operate. But don't you think that it should be something that we can freely choose or not? And that, in the essence, I think, is what this bill is about. I appreciate the opportunity to come and have my public testimony with you today, and I really would welcome any questions and the chance to answer them.
Thank you. I'm going to try to work my way through this public hearing today because we've got one more bill to go, and I've got one of my colleagues here that has to go at 3 o'clock, and we need to do some actions on the other bill. So we'll not do any final decisions on this bill today, and I appreciate your taking the time to come here and recognize the problem you had with the timing of this, and I'm understanding of that, so we'll bring this back at a later date for further work. I want to read some letters of support in here, and in the meantime, Mara, is it Roche and Donalda Donaldson and Ellen CeeLo. Letter in support, Senate Bill 734 from Thomas E. Bunyam, Hill County Commissioner. Letter in favor from Mark A. Comer, M.D. Letter in support from about 12 or 15 people here, largely of the Bond family and some Yance and Olivers. Letter in support from Timothy J. Ganaway, County Commissioner, Clatsop County. Letter of support from Dr. David Nevels and Mrs. Jean Nevels. Letter of support from John and Nellie Evans. Letter of support from Robert Johnstone, Yamhill County Commissioner. Letter of support from five members of, they call themselves, the, I believe it's either Pigwet or Pigway family. A letter of support from Terry K. Tallman, a judge of Marl County. They call our commissioners judges there. Another letter of support from Sonia Martin, and that includes the letters of support for Senate Bill 734. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Maura C. Roach, and I am here today representing Planned Parenthood, testifying in opposition to Senate Bill 734. Planned Parenthood provides thousands of Oregonians each year with family planning services. and Planned Parenthood knows the value and importance of affordable, voluntary family planning services, especially for the working uninsured in Oregon. And that's why we oppose Senate Bill 734, which would allow county health departments to opt out of providing, and I quote, parent and child health services, which for the committee's information would include not only family planning services, but all prenatal services, as well as the WIC program. Family planning services are too important to be provided on an at-will basis, and they should not be relegated to discretionary services. No American woman should be denied access to family planning assistance because of her economic condition. I believe, therefore, that we should establish as a national goal the provision of family planning to all who want but cannot afford them. Those are the words of Richard Nixon, who, as President of the United States, signed the Title 10 bill into law, which is America's Family Planning Program, and the program that provides federal funding to the county health departments to cover family planning services. I think it's also interesting to note that then-Congressman George Bush Sr., as well as our own Senator Mark Hatfield, were both co-sponsors of Title 10 legislation at the federal level. For more than 30 years, Title 10 has been the nation's major program to reduce unintended pregnancy by providing birth control for low-income women. Title 10 matches state dollars at a rate of 9 to 1, one of the highest federal match rates because family planning services are considered one of the most cost-effective public health services. It's estimated that for every dollar spent on family planning, $3 are saved on related health and social service costs. And while Oregon does a pretty good job of meeting the need for family planning services, there is still a significant unmet need for family planning in Oregon. Oregon's family planning clinics serve 72,550 women, representing about 39% of the estimated number of women in need. Publicly supported family planning services are estimated to avert 16,900 pregnancies in Oregon each year, and approximately 14% of women of childbearing age are living in poverty, and 14% of those don't have access to private health insurance or Medicaid in Oregon. Also, I think it's important to note, given previous testimony, that the age range of those who consume family planning services that are the greatest are women aged 20 to 24. Senate Bill 734 is not just a bad idea because it would allow counties to stop providing a service that makes up the very underpinnings of the public health system, but it could severely reduce the Title 10 grant funding the state of Oregon receives. Title 10 is stretching Oregon's dwindling public health dollars further than any other health care program, and Senate Bill 734 would jeopardize Title 10 services and dollars to the state of Oregon. Planned Parenthood urges you to oppose Senate Bill 734. Without publicly supported family planning services, it is estimated that there would be 40% more abortions annually in the United States than currently occur. Family planning is smart prevention, good public policy, and fiscally responsible. Please support Oregon's current system of family planning service provision by opposing Senate Bill 734. I'd be happy to take any questions from the committee.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
I don't want to talk too long because we do have that other bill coming, and that's important too, but how much, you talked about the 9-to-1 match, and I said in Ways and Means Human Services all the time, and we have match rates that are usually 1-to-1. For welfare and a lot of things. 9-to-1 is an amazing match. So if Senate Bill 734 would pass, how much federal money could we lose?
It's hard to estimate because, of course, we don't know how many counties would opt out of providing the service, although Senator Fisher read a pretty long list of letters from various counties that might possibly consider undertaking that. I know that Donalda Dodson, who's with the department, the Health Division, is going to talk a little bit about that. But in any case, it would still be significant because it's a 9-to-1 match, and at such a high match rate, even if it were just a few counties that were to opt out, it would still represent a very significant financial loss to the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Rick, can you explain to me, you know, because you notice my name appears on the bill, why when we turn over to page 2 of the bill at line 3, we see the elimination of parent and child health services, including family planning clinics, described in ORS. And that, of course, is where they got the reference to the parent and child health services. Why was it necessary to so broadly change that section right there?
Senator Fisher, Senator George, I don't really have the answer to that question right now. I can look it up, or perhaps one of the people at the podium can answer. I'm thinking that because it does include family planning clinics, it just would be a broad, that was thought to.
But it would appear that the intent of the bill was to just exclude, or not exclude, but make it an option relative to the family planning and birth control services as the Section 1 describes. Okay.
I'll be looking to that.
Okay. Thank you.
As Chairman Fisher, members of the committee, I'm Danelda Dodds, and I'm an assistant administrator at the Department of Human Services, Oregon Health Division, and I'm the director for the Center for Child and Family Health, where some of these services reside. To have my written testimony, I would just like to hit a couple of the high points. I would just like to comment that that was one of our concerns also about why all child and parent services were noted in here. This is one of our a major concern. Family planning is a component of child and family health services.
Well, I can assure you that that was not the intent of the bill. In fact, it was a shock to me. I never even looked back there.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read this piece right here, I said, well, where in the world would you get that?
Mm-hmm.
And to find that apparently in drafting the bill they'd done that, do you see any reason why we couldn't change that? Literally to put back everything, and to me, just to put in the may provide those things would clarify that part.
Well, I think that does solve part of the problem, yes. However, family planning services are a critical part of child and family services because we know that parents' ability to decide when to have children, assistance in having children, is a key component for their health, their family health, and for the woman's health, as well as for the child's health. And just to say that for 30 years, we've been providing family planning services and child and family services in our state, and these have been an integral part of the public health service system. Were we not to be able to have that, that could limit access to many individuals. Able to say that they may not provide certain services. As we know, we're a very rural state, and for some of our families, they may have to travel long distances to even be able to access those services. And as was pointed out, we're talking about the services of family planning, nutrition, prenatal, and all of those. So, one of our key issues from the Department of Human Services is the assurance that these preventative health services can be available. That it's an ongoing expectation that those are available to the community and that local governments have those available for them. Not only that, but I have worked at the local level and I know that those are expectations from the local community. I've seen clients who have come in and said they just knew that that was going to be available to them. So that is an expectation. This bill could seriously fragment our comprehensive safety net of public health services, and it could impede the access to some individuals. In addition to this, it has some potential risks, as we've talked about, the cost factor, the investment of family planning, very good for our economy as well as for our communities. We estimate that just last year alone, 17,000 unintended pregnancies were averted due to having family planning services. I'd also like to point out that these services are voluntary. You know, clients come of their own will. This are not imposed upon this. This is a decision that they make. The services are also given not only to limit family size, but counseling services are provided to assist individuals who are wanting to expand their family. Just to speak a little bit concerned about the Family and Child Services, we do know that, as was pointed out in our testimony, that $17 million alone goes to counties for WIC services in a biennium, about $3 million for family planning services, and another $2 million for perinatal services. In most cases, these funds are available to Oregon on the basis of our ability to demonstrate to the federal government that our population is willing to see that these services are provided. So we would run the risk of not being able to take advantage of those opportunities. It's also another concern we have, should these not be an assurance for every community, is that we're not assured that we'd be able to find providers in some of these communities. As you know, some of our communities are very sparse, and by having these as a requirement, we're assured that attention is given to that resource for those constituents. Last year, we served over 58,000 women and men in our family planning clinic. We have also continued to provide services to assist with unintended pregnancy, improving prenatal care access, improving birth outcomes. And it's critical to note that parent and child services are a primary preventive in nature and avoid serious downstream costs, as you know about. I'd be glad to answer any questions that I can.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, I'm sure.
Just went back and asked Bob if he'd intended anything like this, and I think what we've been fed on this bill is a poison pill. And it's my intention to make sure this gets corrected and find out why it happened. That was not the intention, and obviously none of the commissioners who have written and the numbers who are going to write would in any way want to eliminate public health services. They have no intention of doing that. But what I think they are asking for is a little bit of discretion to say, gee, you know, this community finds it offensive that we're being mandated to provide things that we don't agree with. And so this was an opportunity to give local control back. And at the same time, we know that a community will either demand or reject certain kinds of services, and they have a right to do that. And we're constantly telling our local folks what to do, and I think this is one time where we can offer them a chance to have some of that discretion, but at the same time, we're going to eliminate the poison pill.
Go ahead, Ms. Lowe.
And I'm embarrassed that we had to get in here today to find that.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
a question. Senator George has pointed out that his embarrassment about this bill, but it says here that an identical bill was heard in the House Public and Advocacy Committee as this bill. Did this issue come up over in the House?
I don't know. We have that spot. I don't know. It wasn't there. No.
They didn't, yeah?
Yes, it did. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, actually this issue was raised by the Health Division in the House Committee testimony as well as being raised by Planned Parenthood at that time.
Okay. I looked through my file. Now, it's possible that you all communicated with my office of pointing that out, but I don't find it in here. Okay. It'd be nice if we'd had that before we got in here today. We'll work on this, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Ms. Lowe.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe. I'm a legislative advocate for the Oregon Law Center, which is a nonprofit that provides free legal services to low-income Oregonians. And the center is often called upon to assist low-income Oregonians with access to health care. And that is for the uninsured, it's for the underinsured, it's for Oregon's working poor. And I would like to say that I was one of those who called attention to, on page 2, lines 3 and 4, because parent and child health services really does include some of the most important services that Oregon makes available particularly to low-income folks who are trying to make responsible choices regarding prenatal care, regarding well-child clinics, immunization, WIC, those services that really say that as parents, they are being responsible for seeking health services for their children. And the way the current law is written, it is very clear that family planning is considered an integral component of parent and child services. The Oregon Law Center would also like to say that family planning is also an active responsibility of Oregon families. And we really see the way this bill is written that it's going to place barriers. And if I may, a personal note, why should a service that is available to those of us who are part of the private insurance sector, where, and I will say that our first grandchild was a great joy to our family, but he would not have been here if there had not been family planning services that were available to us. Why should those kinds of services not be available to low-income Oregonians? Because family planning is not just to keep from having children. It's often to make it possible for children to be born. And this law really is suggesting that we're going to have two classes of citizens in Oregon in regard to health care.
Thank you very much. We'll allow Senator George and some to work and do some work on this bill. We will be bringing it back. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 734 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 796. The staff introduced the bill.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Bill.
Oh, I blew it again. Excuse me. Let's go back and close this and go back to a public hearing on Senate Bill 734. And I have a letter here in opposition from Marsha Kelly for the Women's Rights Coalition. We'll enter that into record. Public hearing on Senate Bill 734 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 796.
Requires the Mental Health Developmental Disabilities Division to apply for waiver of federal requirements and adopt rules under which people with developmental disabilities receiving services from division in residential settings may retain a portion of earned income and remain eligible for Medicaid benefits and placed in residential settings. Medicaid recipients are required to contribute to the cost of care within residential settings that are paid for by Medicare. This is a state Medicaid being a federal state managing program. It includes SSI and Social Security benefits for people with developmental disabilities. Individuals, many people with developmental disabilities are employed and but are only allowed to retain a portion of this earned income. The remaining monies must be turned over to the state for cost of care charges. Currently, the division estimates that 3,000 or 4,000 people with developmental disabilities may be affected by this bill, with a general fund impact of a little over $1 million, and the 2001 federal poverty level for a single person is $8,590, and at 250% is approximately $21,475. This does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. We have Catherine White and Judy Cuneo. I haven't seen you for a while, Judy. And Helen, Sunny, is it? Go right ahead.
Mr. Chair.
Hurry.
I know. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I know we're in a very short time frame. I'll make my comments really very brief. This bill, we believe, is about doing the right thing. People with developmental disabilities currently are unable to keep their earned income. They turn over percentages of their unearned income, which is their Social Security and SSDI or other benefits, to help pay for their cost of care. We now have people who are earning income, and we want to encourage them to be employed and to have the ability to use those dollars in productive ways and become more productive members of our community. We are urging your support for this bill to eliminate this offset barrier to independence, and we hope to have this bill be passed two ways and means where it can become a part of the negotiations on the developmental disabilities budget.
Thank you. Go ahead. Oh. Any order you
Hello, my name is Helen Honey.
Senator Fisher and members of the committee. My name is Helen Honey. I'm the financial director for Shangri-La Corporation and have been for most of the 13 years that I've worked there. Shangri-La serves approximately 125 people in housing, 25 to 30% of whom would be affected by this bill. I believe that you should support this bill not only because it's fair, but because it's efficient. I was asked mostly to speak in terms of the paperwork necessary to track the earned income and report it on a monthly basis to several agencies simply to compute this offset and then turn around and collect it from people. It costs a lot of money to track these very few dollars round and round and round, and I think it would be a good idea to stop it. I also would like to speak to the disincentive to work that it creates. If I don't know that they've been handed out, but on the back of my written testimony is a graph that basically shows that as a person earns over $65, they actually lose money because the offset takes back their gross wages in excess of $65, and yet they still have to pay FICA on it. So if they were to earn exactly $850 for the month, they would get to keep absolutely none of that paycheck. So as people or their advocates begin to realize that, they also begin to realize that the best thing for them to do is to earn no more than $65. And that's in direct contrast with all of the things that we try to do to train people to be hardworking and earn high wages. That's pretty much all I'd like to say. Thank you.
Chair Fisher and members of the committee. My name is Judy Cuneo. I'm here to talk with you about my personal experience. This is a very emotional issue for me. Due to the lack of time we have, I will have my personal assistant, Carol Simon, read the testimony I wrote. I will answer any questions that you may have after she is finished.
Right, have you got enough room there?
Yeah,
I think there's
sure.
One more chair, possibly.
It's connected.
No, it's hooked up.
Up until April of 1999, I was in the developmental disability system. I was getting SSDI, and I was working for the residential provider who provided services to me. At that time, I had to pay a residential offset. The more money I made, the less I got to keep for myself. I lived in a supported living slot, and I lived alone with 15 hours of support a week if I was lucky. I was able to keep $65 a month out of what I made each month. And this amount has not changed since the beginning, from what we understand.
Yeah.
Out of this $65, I had to buy my own clothing and personal care items. I was trying to live semi-independently, but I kept getting deeper into debt with my residential provider. I didn't want to go back to living in a group home. People with disabilities can't afford to work, but they can't afford not to work either. Something is wrong. I knew that I needed to leave the developmental disability system in order to become self-supporting. I was able to get out of the DD system because I qualify for the Employed Persons with Disabilities program through Senior and Disabled Services. The EPD program completely changed my life for the better. I still live in the same house that I lived in while receiving services, except for now, the house that I live in is in my name and I pay the rent myself. I now pay $105 a month for service that I direct myself. I am able to hire who I want and get more hours of service for less money. I am an employee of the state of Oregon, which enables me to be self-supporting, and I don't pay residential offsets, so I can actually keep the money I earn and support myself. People with a disability don't want a free ride. We just want to have a life. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I also submitted testimony from Jerry Bieberly, who was unable to be here today.
Okay, thanks. We will read that in the record. I have a letter here from Gerald Bieberly in support of Senate Bill 796, and we'll make that part of the record.
Thank you.
See, we have James Taves, who made his mark just a little tiny bit in the floor, and the tail up over a ways into the against, so we'll bring him up here and see how close he can come to walking the line here. And also Ellie Jenny, I think maybe if, James, if you can get over to one side there and move a chair, Ellie can get up here while you're talking, and we'll save absolutely as much time as we can here. In honor of Senator Shields, need to be somewhere else here pretty quick.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, James Taves from the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division. I'll be very, very brief. We support the intent of the bill, and in fact, we have already implemented the first half of what the bill requires. We've already submitted a request that has been approved by the federal government, changing the language in our home and community-based waiver that would allow us to allow persons with a developmental disability served in our system to retain up to 250% of the federal poverty level before they start buying back in as a way of preserving their Medicaid program. The dilemma for us right now is that the money that would be needed to replace the residential offsets in our residential provider rates is not in the governor's budget. And so that's the obvious concern and problem that we have. But as far as the intent goes, we've already made the change. We've adopted almost identical language that is in the senior services waiver that Judy was referring to for employment for persons with disabilities. And that's obviously where our heart is. But at this point, it's not included in making up the residential rate. So that would make the difference.
Go ahead, Ellie.
I'm Chair Fisher, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ellie Jenny, and I come to speak in support of that, of the, what is it, 796 that we're talking
yes.
about. I think it's a good idea. My only thing I would say is that I wish there was a way that folks who fit in the DD population could keep all the money they make rather than up to 250%. I mean, that's just my personal, this is a step. It would be fun for me after lobbying 25 years the Social Security to finally change the Medicaid program so disabled people could work and keep their own money, that the government makes money and saves money and doesn't really lose it. So I think this is a good idea.
Well, I appreciate your testimony. I might add here for the record that I have discussed this issue with co-chair of Ways and Means Center, Senator Hannon, and he has given me the okay to send this bill on down to his capable care. So I appreciate the work that you folks have done and the hard work and effort, and we'll wish you success as you pursue one more step here. And I'm going to close the public hearing, go into a session on Senate Bill 796. Yes, Senator George.
I would like to urge that we move Senate Bill 796,
yeah,
correct, to Ways and Means and express our strong, complete, and enthusiastic support for its passage.
All right, Senator George moves Senate Bill 796 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation by prior reference. Further discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Senator Shields.
Aye.
Senator George.
Aye.
Senator Fisher.
Aye. Motion carries, and you're on your way, folks. Both Senator Carter and Senator Meserly are gone, but I asked their opinion on this bill, and they told me that they were in support of it too. So, good luck to all of you, and appreciate your coming here, and I appreciate your consideration of our timeline this afternoon. So I know you could have flooded our room today. Close the work session on Senate Bill 796 and adjourn the Committee on Health and Human Services.